It's Open Air on the Rhythm of News service of Jefferson Public Radio. We're also streaming online at www.ijpr.org. I'm Eric Thiel. We've got another great live session for you today. Joining me in the JPR studios, all the way from New York, Mr. Garland Jeffries. Welcome, sir.
Great, great to be here. You know, I like coming into these kind of college studios, and I've been doing it my whole life, it seems. I remember when one of the first times was at Yale.
Yale University.
And I went to one of these kind of things, and I was very smart back then. When I left the studio, I wrote up a little postcard and put a stamp on it, and I said, "Who was that guy who you just had on the show?" And I mailed it in the thing, you know, just like I was learning promotion even way back then. Mm.
Yeah. The first tune of yours that ever really kind of made it into the mainstream was all the way back in, 1973, Wild in the Streets?
Yeah.
And you had some great people on that one. Dr. John was on that track. The Brecker Brothers were on that track.
Yeah.
But strangely, it wasn't even a song that was on your album, right? It was a song that was released as a standalone single by the label?
Yeah, this is a good thing to bring up because, you know, musicians out there need to know that, fortunately now, the record business as we used to know it does not exist anymore. And often, back in the day, which is really not that far away, you know, you were not in control very much. Now you can be. You can dictate what songs come out when, on what albums, and what have you. So I had made this song, Wild in the Streets, which I was very enthusiastic about. And they did very little, as usual, back in those days, for sure. And when the time came for that relationship to be over, I bought the master.
Oh, really?
I bought it. That was like a smart thing, smarter than I realized. I bought the master, and then I put it on subsequent records. That's why you'll see it on another album, you know. So the message out there, folks, is, you know, don't sell your publishing. Hold on to your songwriting. Don't let the assholes fool you. That's all.
I watched a short documentary of you online where you talked about spending many years using these micro cassette recorders to help you capture your music, or using things like payphones where you would actually call home and leave a message for yourself on your answering machine just to capture what it was that was bouncing around in your head. Was there finally a point that you made the crossover to using a digital recorder?
No. I still do the same thing. I have on my table, like in my living room, just a regular wooden table, and I have a couple of recorders right there and with a couple of cassettes, you know. When I have an idea that I think is really cool, I'll just sing it right into cassette right then and there, you know, for a couple of reasons. And I would carry the cassette out in the street with me, too. And then sometimes when I didn't, I would call home and leave a message on the machine, humming the tune or a lyric that I didn't want to forget. I mean, I thought that was quite a modern kind of idea, you know, to do that and save your songs. And, you know, because all your ideas are valuable to you, you know, especially if you're a songwriter. And, you know, that's the way I started, and I continue to do. And I've since know that Keith Richards does the same thing. So there you go.
Garland Jeffries is my guest live on Open Air here on Jefferson Public Radio. Streaming online, ijpr.org. The new album is called Truth Serum. We will talk about that album in a bit. I'd love to hear some music. Before we do that, though, a big plug for Fretwell Music Shop here in Ashland that just opened up. That's loaning us a really nice Epiphone tube amp for today's live session. So thanks to the guys over at Fretwell Music. What do you want to play first?
I want to introduce my friend
here. Please do.
Adam is a fantastic guitar player. He really knows how to play the guitar, and he plays with me in my band, and we're also friends, you know. Adam Roth, a fantastic player.
Did the friendship happen first, or the bandmate happen first?
I guess our friend is sort of a mixed up kind of thing. I can't really say.
It's blossomed.
But we like each other.
Yeah. What are you gonna do first?
We're gonna do Coney Island Winter. 1, 2, 3, 4. The Humanity strikes, humility speaks. Insanity lives on the edge of the streets. This is a story, and it happens every day. Politicians kiss my ass. Your promises that break like glass. Royalty looks down, and me, I wanna kiss the ground. And 22 stops to the city, 22 stops to the city, 22 stops to the city, 22 stops. Freezing cold, no time to weep. Boardwalk's dead on a midnight creek. Colder than a polar bear, but I don't care. Coney Island winter.
Hey!
Coney Island winter. Woman walks down the street. Tears are rolling down her face. Frozen on her cheeks. Steeplechase, no time to waste. Heaven bless, heaven sent. Hark the angels, can't pay the rent. All the money has been spent. All the games are broken down. Rust has fallen to the ground. They say they're gonna fix this town. Straight from City Hall. Coney Island winter.
Hey!
Coney Island winter. Woman walks down the street. Tears are rolling down her face. Frozen on her cheeks. Steeplechase, no time to waste. Heaven bless, heaven send. Hark the angels, can't pay the rent. All the money has been spent. All the games are broken down. Rust has fallen to the ground. They say they're gonna fix this town. Straight from City Hall. Coney Island winter.
Hey!
Coney Island winter. Last stop off for the Iron Horse. Ride shuts down on the winter course. Round and round. Round and round on Ferris wheel comes to a stop. Standing on mermaid and surf, shutters have been shut. Colder than a knife that cut. Streets for summer, the Coney Island strut. I'm on a mission of my own. Don't wanna die on stage with a microphone in my hand. In my hand. Coney Island winter.
Hey!
Coney Island winter.
It's Garland Jeffries live in the JPR studios here on Open Air. You can also catch us online at ijpr.org. We'll have audio of the session and photographs from today's live session up on our website later today. Garland, going back to the, I guess, early 80s, I read about a really interesting encounter you had with, of all people, Gene Simmons of Kiss, who gave you, I guess, what, very brief words of encouragement about one specific song of yours.
Yeah, I first want to say that you never know who your allies are. You never know. You'd never think that, you know, some people that you have an idea of who they are that, you know, you'd get, like, brilliant advice from. And I was taking a break, and I stepped outside, and within a minute, Gene Simmons came out of another studio on the same, we were on the same floor. And Gene, I knew Gene from Greenwich Village, walking around, like that sort of stuff. We weren't really friends. And Gene says, "Hey, what is that song you got there? I'm hearing coming out, you know, of the studio." I said, "Oh, it's a song I'm working on. I don't even think I'm going to put it on the album. It's a little bit long." And he says, "It's kind of catchy, you know." He says, "Look, I got to go." And he went back into the studio, the other studio, and I went back into my studio. And the next day, a couple days later, the same exact thing happened. I went out of the studio, and 30 seconds later, Gene Simmons walks out of the same other studio. And he walks over and he says, "That's a catchy song, I'm telling you. I'm listening to it. I heard it now a couple times. I can hear it from being outside the room. And it's catchy." I said, "You think so?" He said, it's catchy. You never know. This is what he's saying. I really wasn't paying attention to him that much, but I did hear what he said. Wasn't really focused on what he was saying. In any case, the record company, as they often do, as you can tell, I'm not a big record company fan. The record company hated the album. How's that? Hated this album, and you know, I was kind of shaken by it. I really was, and I did get a call from the Paris branch of the company, and they said, "We know that the mother company doesn't like the album, but we love the album. We'd like you to, you know," I had a talk with her, and she said, "We'd like you to, you know, maybe think about coming over to Paris and talking about the whole thing, meeting and seeing if we can come up with a concept, a plan." Okay, so I do. I go to Paris. They pay for the trip. I mean, I'm definitely going, right?
Yeah.
So it was really cool. And I go in for the meeting, and she says, "Yeah, we listened to the album. We think that a song, Bad Dream, should be the single. We think that it has a lot of potential, and we'd like to, you know, you to bring your band over, and we'd like you to go on a little tour, and we'll promote it around that. And what do you think about that?" I said, "Well, I like all that, but Bad Dream is not the song."
Do you hear that voice, that Gene Simmons voice in the back?
The Gene Simmons voice is very well installed in my mind at this point. And I said to him, the song that I think is a hit is Matador. I said, "Matador, it's so long. We can't put it on the album." I said, "This is it." And for some reason, I really stuck to my guns, you know, with no real evidence or proof, just the words of the great God, Gene Simmons. And so they agreed to do it. So they arranged I went back to New York. I put a band together. We set it all up. I came over. We start doing shows. And they released the album in advance. They set it up all in the right way. And sure enough, after the first weekend, it sold 25,000 copies. 25,000 copies. And continues to be a great source of revenue in my life since 1979, 1980.
Did taking that stand then help you kind of dig in your heels for the rest of your career in terms of making the decisions you wanted without influence from others?
It's a gradual growth. You know, you know, those big, these big bad record company people, you tend to feel like you're less than them. You know, it's very typical. Yeah. And over time, you know, you realize, wait a minute, I'm making the music. You know, I'm gonna even make my own label, and that's what's happening now, mm-hmm. which I like to see, is that, you know, people who are musicians right here in this school, you know, are probably making their own records and finding ways for distribution and setting up situations so they can gig and perform, you know, and that's in the end, especially today, that's what it's about, performing.
Yeah.
You know.
So that album came out, I guess, in 82, 83, Rock and Roll Adult, is that right?
See, the single came out, Matador, came out in, I guess, it was 79.
Okay.
So I guess 79, 80 would be that period.
Moving forward from there, at least especially for us out here on the West Coast, there's kind of a dark period for you where you weren't releasing albums. What was going on in that interim period? Because you spent more than a decade not making any albums, or at least not releasing any.
Yes.
So what was going on during that time?
Well, one of the great things in my life took place. My wife said to me one day, you know, we hadn't even spoken of it. And she said, you know, I'd like to have a baby. And I said, you know, I was kind of sort of stunned. But I did say immediately, okay, let's do it. You know, let's get back to work, you know. And that's what we did. Within a year's time, I realized that this is something that I really wanted. I didn't really even know. My background wasn't so great growing up. And my wife had said to me, this would be a great opportunity to make the family that you want to make, that you want to have. And that's exactly what happened. And I took my kid to school every morning, to nursery school. We sang along the way, and we developed a fantastic relationship, like what he's doing now. He has a young son who's, what, 3 years old?
Yeah.
3 years old, a lovely, lovely kid. And he's, you know, trying to spend as much time as, you know, like that, you know.
Yeah, and your daughter's name is?
Savannah Ray.
And she makes music, too.
And she's a real budding human being in every regard. You know, she's definitely potentially a very good musician.
Garland Jeffries is my guest live in the JPR studios. His newest album is called Truth Serum. I want to talk about 2011 when you jumped with both feet back into the music biz. But before that, let's hear another tune. What do you want to play next?
Okay, let's, why don't we play, let's play a song from Truth Serum. I'm sailing away on this ship of fools. This cafe, I'm gonna sing the blues. Some folks say that I'm here for them, that I'm here for you, but I'm here for me, that's true. On the ship of fools. On the ship of fools. On the ship of fools. My friends, they lie behind my back. New ones come, I'm so confused. My mind's made up, I won't compromise. I'm all mixed up, my eyes can't see the truth. On the ship of fools. On the ship of fools. On the ship of fools. You know I've been here once before. I'm gonna see that ship again. From whence I don't know when. I'm caught up here again on the ship of fools. On a ship of fools. On a ship of fools, yeah. On a ship of fools. What a bridge. You know I've been here once before. I wanna see that ship again. But whence I don't know when. I'm caught up here again on the ship of fools. On the ship of fools.
That is Garland Jeffries live on Open Air here on the Rhythm and News Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Also online at IJPR.org. Music from the new album called Truth Serum. So I guess 2011 is about the time that you decided to jump back into music wholeheartedly. Although I have to wonder whether the music was always there bouncing around in your head. You just weren't actively recording and making albums. Is that right?
I think that's precise. I was writing songs from time to time, and I have to say that, as you can tell from my what I said earlier, I experienced a lot of frustration in the record business because I've always wanted to do what I wanted to do in terms of the music, the songs, what my interests are, the kind of lyrics that I write about, the kind of subjects that I'm interested in. And the record business is really not interested in my subjects, you know, as such. They're interested in money, particularly, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm interested in money, too. But I'm interested in the kind of music that I want to make and the kind of story and the kind of point of view that I come from.
I'm glad that you brought up that the record company wasn't interested in the stories that you were telling, because a lot of your songs over the years have dealt with racial issues, including the album that we were just referencing, the 2011, The Kingdom in Between, but also an earlier song of yours that you released. The story fascinated me. Don't Call Me Buckwheat.
Yeah.
This actually happened?
Yes, it happened at a Shea Stadium. It was an amazingly publicized game, because Nolan Ryan was pitching against Dwight Gooden for the only time, you know, and I definitely wanted to go to that. During the game, I got up to get some Franks for the guys that I was with, you know, just going to get, and I was sort of like standing up and sort of watching the game at the same time. You know how you're watching the game and leaving the area at the same time, and the guy said, "Hey, Buckwheat, get the fuck out of here. Hey, Buckwheat, get out," you know. What did I feel?
Yeah. Was it anger or sadness?
I felt shaken by it, because it was I was completely disarmed. Who was thinking about anything like that? I was really shaken by it, and it was very upsetting. I walked a ways from there to the Frankfurter thing, and I got online, and you know, I was gathering my feelings and my thinking, and I was just not happy. And I said to myself, "Don't call me Buckwheat." Mm. That was what I said. And that became the title of the next album, which has a picture of me on the cover in my baseball uniform the day that Jackie Robinson broke the color line.
Oh, wow.
It's the same date, April 15th, 1947. Now, I wasn't standing out there on April 15th, 1947, but it just... It, you know, the Buckwheat story, the Buckwheat title, the Jackie Robinson. I was a big fan of Jackie Robinson as time went on. My family were big Jackie Robinson's fans. If you were black or brown, you know, or even white, you know, Jackie Robinson, and you came from Brooklyn especially, Jackie Robinson was in your heart, you know. So that was it. That's how the Buckwheat title came up, and then I was then proceeded to write this song, Don't Call Me Buckwheat, Don't Call Me Jew Boy, Don't Call Me Blackie Boy, Your Negro Toy, Don't Call Me Johnny O'Darkey, and all these kinds of descriptions of racial epithets are in the song, you know, and I suggest you guys out there, guys and gals, check it out.
When you got back into making music full-time, were you at all concerned about the chops, whether you'd still have the ability to get out there on stage night after night and still sound and play and sing the way that you did 10 years earlier?
Whatever the reservation I might have had, it was minor. I knew that it would be best to start small, and I started doing what I recommend a lot of people do today, start playing at house concerts, mm-hmm. which has become a big deal now. And it's a great way to come and play for friends, and then, you know, eventually you get brazen enough to actually ask for money for your performances, and that's what I started doing. I started playing again on that level. Playing at people's houses, benefits, charity stuff, getting back into the swing, getting back into the groove, and now I'm playing all over again, yeah. And I'm enjoying my performing and the whole public world again in a big way.
We referenced how music was bouncing around in your head even during that decade, because Truth Serum's now the second album of yours in less than 2 years. So those songs must have been gestating.
I think so.
I read that most, if not all, of the songs on Truth Serum were one take.
Yes, that's right.
That seems kind of remarkable with all of the tools at artists' disposal these days to go back and fix and tweak, that you laid most of them down in one try.
Well, I'll tell you, that's exactly what happened. It was unusual. Because if they weren't all on one take, at least 8 out of 10
were,
you know. And I've always wanted to do that, meaning I've always done that. I shouldn't say one. I've always done that, but not on that level. Because I love to hire or work with very, very good musicians who can lay it down on one take. They rehearse the song. It's one take, you know. And, you know, I play with Steve Jordan, for example, Larry Campbell, these kind of guys who are used to being in the studio and playing. And and I'm good on my first take. I seem to have my best emotion and feeling at that time. I'm ready. You know, I'm a little nervous, a little anxious, which is important to have a little of that. And then the drummer counts the song off. And I kick in, I got it, you know, and I'm always looking for that. That's a big thing with me. I learned that years ago from a great engineer, Roy Sakala.
I think we have time for maybe one more tune, but before I have you play that, we lost a great musician just a couple of weeks ago that you have ties with going all the way back to your years at Syracuse,
yeah.
Lou Reed.
Yeah.
Did you guys stay in contact over the years, interact much on a musical level?
Mainly on a friendship level.
Really?
We met in Syracuse in, I guess it was 61, I think it was. And we became friends pretty quickly, primarily around the fact that we liked doo-wop music.
Hmm.
That's how it started. And we'll always talk about it. You know, we really loved it. I'll just say this little tale about it. I played at a place in New York called Joe's Pub, and I knew Lou was coming down to see the show, you know, and he came down, and, you know, sometimes he would come to see my shows, I would come to see his, you know, or sometimes we'd play together. So he came down with his wife, Lori, and but he had to leave early, you know. At a certain point, he signals me that he's leaving, and he goes out leaving. So I immediately started singing one of those old songs,
To try to hook him in.
To get his attention, you know. I have a girlfriend. She says I'm her only one. We want to get married, but we're so young. That song. He turns around. He smiles. And he gets down on his knees. Gets down on his knees. Bows down to me, you know. That was really, really fun. It was really good.
Well, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you, and thanks so much for taking some time and visiting with us. Can we hear one more tune?
Sure.
What do you want to go out with?
We'll give you 35 millimeter dreams. Two, three, four. I got 35 millimeter dream, and Greta Garbo's here, queen of the movie queen. She's playing hard to get. She wants a tea and a toast. She hasn't got none yet. Just flew in from the West Coast. She loves Broadway best. I got 35 millimeter dream. 35 millimeter dream. 35 millimeter dream. John Garfield cries out loud. Humphrey Bogart smiles out loud. Betty Davis, she weeps. She plays a pure white slave. There goes a Rolls Royce car. The love fans always. Here comes a full-blown movie star. Marlon Brando, he gets all the rage. 35 millimeter dream. 35 millimeter dream. Bumping to Orson Welles. Everybody says he's working on his movie script. It says rated X. Midwest will never ever tell. Starring Cary Grant and Valentina's Van and Charlie Chaplin's Tramp. Jolie Joseph E. Chan. I got 35 millimeter dream. 35 millimeter dream. 35 millimeter dream.
That is Garland Jeffries live on Open Air here on the Rhythm and News Service of Jefferson Public Radio. You can also find us online at ijpr.org. Again, we'll have audio from today's live session and a photo gallery up on the site later today.
I want to mention that my good friend here, Tom Roth, is on second guitar. Man, let's not forget him.